Your note should be in front of you. Should say Lesson 58, Coming to America, John Nelson Darby's North American Ministry. Now, last week we sort of turned a corner again and came to the United States. And by way of review, I did not have time this week to animate these points. So when I bring this each slide up, the whole thing is going to show up. So just keep in mind. But last week we began to survey the American Millenarian Movement between 1800 and 1860. All right. And I just have a few sort of points in review to refresh your memory about what we saw, okay? The first thing we saw was that postmillennialism dominated American eschatology for the majority of these years, okay? So the majority of the years between 1800 and 1860, postmillennialism was the predominant view as far as eschatology is concerned by most of the American churches and denominations. And we talked last week about all the reasons why. I'm not going to get into that. Second, we looked at some fringe groups. We looked at the Mormons and the Shakers and how they diverged from the theological establishment. We saw that the Shakers thought that the Second Advent had already occurred with the incarnation of God in Mother Ann Lee, the female and complementary form to Christ of the First Advent. Then on the other hand, we saw that the Mormon founder Joseph Smith taught an apocalyptic and premillennial eschatology that was not always clearly articulated, and while looking for the return of Christ through Mormons' labor to build the New Jerusalem in Utah. So we looked at, I called those last week the millennial fringe. They're sort of on the outskirts of the main group of millenarians being postmillennial at the time and thinking that they're going to bring in the kingdom. And then we looked at William Miller. And we looked at how by far he was the most orthodox. William Miller never claimed to be a special prophet. He never claimed to have some sort of direct special information from God. He never denied the deity of Christ or any of the sort of cardinal doctrines of the faith. He was a historicist premillennialist. Okay? So we saw that he was the American equivalent of Edward Irving. He applied a year-to-day theory and went into the interpretation of prophecy, and he predicted that the Lord would return October 22, 1844, which obviously did not happen. When it didn't happen, there was a lot of the American millenarian movement suffered some harm over his failed prediction, and so that was definitely something that kind of set things back for a while. And the last review point, they call this the Great Disappointment. Okay, all this build up to October 22nd, 1844, and then nothing happens. This becomes known as the Great Disappointment, and the Great Disappointment caused American Christians to do one of the following three things. Okay, either one, return and embrace postmillennialism. Number two, seek out other forward-thinking movements such as the social gospel or other things of that nature. Or three, to embrace a new type of premillennialism that was being imported from Great Britain, and that would be dispensational premillennialism. So the goal of this lesson then is to begin looking at how the dispensational teachings of Darby impacted the American millenarian movement. So I just want to be clear with you. What we looked at last time, it was a survey. Let me see what I do with my marker. Is there a... What we did last time is we surveyed American millenarianism from 1800 to 1860. Okay, we saw that most Americans were postmillennial. Okay, we saw that on the fringe you had the Shakers, you had the Mormons, and then you had the Millerites. These guys were historicists in their interpretation of the Book of Revelation. Okay, now. With this prediction of Miller on 10/22/1844 doesn't come to pass, this becomes known as the Great Disappointment. Okay? That Great Disappointment is going to have a negative impact upon the millennial movement. It's going to force people to do one of the three things there. They're either going to turn back and re-embrace postmillennialism, Number one. Number two, they're either going to, or they will go and embrace some other forward-thinking thing, such as social gospel or eventually the New Deal, that type of thing. Man trying to, you know, help out man and that sort of stuff. Or third, some of them are going to embrace Darbyism, dispensational premillennialism, that's going to start to come across the Atlantic Ocean around this time. So the main point of this lesson is to look at how the ideas of Darby come across the Atlantic and begin to be introduced in the United States, then how they begin to matriculate through the American denominations and have an impact on the thinking of people in the United States. So, coming to America, most of the lesson is going to fall under this sort of heading. So point number one, the great period of expansion for the Plymouth Brethren movement is dated from 1832 to 1845, and it was during this first part of this period that Darby did most of his writing. Plymouth Brethren missionaries scattered to many countries all over the world, and a flood of books and tracts from Brethren leaders made their way to the continent and to America. Okay? So, I need to point out to you that this Krauss guy is not in favor of Darby. Okay? He is a historicist premillennialist, and he does not like dispensational theology. So you need to keep that in mind whenever you see his name as a source here. Okay? So, between 1832 and 1845, the Brethren are spreading out, they're writing, they're sending out missionaries both to continental Europe and to North America. And most of Darby's written work is going to be written during that time frame of 1832 to 1845, generally speaking. Darby himself visited Canada as early as 1859. Now, you need to pay attention to this. He was back for extended visits in 1864 and 1866. And he came to the United States in 1870, 1872 through 1873, and 1874. During this time, he visited New York, Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, Boston, and Philadelphia. So Darby, when he comes to the United States, he definitely focuses his attention on major urban centers. I mean, you look at the cities there, and you think about the time period in history, the 1860s, 1870s, these are by far some of the biggest, most influential cities in the country. When you think about New York, Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, Boston, I mean, these are big metropolitan areas, and Darby is focusing most of his attention as far as ministry in the United States on these major urban centers. Now, in a book titled A Historical Sketch of the Brethren Movement, H.A. Ironside states the following regarding the decade of the 1870s. In the 1870s, many of these preachers from Scotland and the north of Ireland came to America and labored with great blessing, particularly in the province of Ontario and in nearby eastern states. Later, the movement extended all over the two countries. So Ironside's testimony is that once the Brethren come, they focus first on in the east. In Canada, their main focus is on Ontario and then some of the major cities in the surrounding states of the United States, which would be New York and Boston, would make the most sense. But from there, they eventually get established somewhat of a foothold, and their ministries are going to spread all throughout Canada and the United States as a result of this. All right. Now, Sandine reports that Darby visited the United States and Canada seven times between 1862 and 1877, actually residing in and traveling through the two countries for nearly seven out of those 16 years. So if you look at the time frame between 1862 and 1877, yet that 16-year time period, Sandine says if you total up the amount of time that Darby was here, it would equal out to about seven years. So in that 16-year window, Darby lives in the United States for seven of those 16 years. So, I mean, that's a fairly substantial length of time when it's all, you know, said and done and totaled up. Okay? His activities in North America began in Toronto during the autumn of 1862. Except for visits to Montreal and Ottawa and one short trip to Halifax, Darby restricted his ministry to the area between London and Toronto, Ontario. The Brethren mission in this area had already been initiated when he arrived, and Darby gave credit to a Mr. R. Evans as the founder of the Word in Canada. An annual conference for Brethren was begun in, Guelph, and proved to be a good occasion both for strengthening the faith of new converts and for winning additional converts. Darby stated the following regarding these Canadian meetings. The evangelists had brought so many younger converts that the beginning of the conference gave less communion than earlier ones, but met the need of the moment. Many came from different parts of the states, and all our evangelists were there, some under tents. The happiest spirit reigned throughout. So, Darby's going to come over in 1862, roughly. Some say as early as 1859, but we'll go with this because this can be proven. And he's going to go and minister mostly where?
Canada.
Canada first. Okay? There's already a Brethren movement in Canada. Okay? So Darby is coming over and he's ministering with people that have already set up different Brethren movements within Canada. And at first he's focusing his attention there between London and Toronto, Ontario. And it says that there are also people coming up from the States, that would be the United States, and are participating in these, for lack of a better term, these conference meetings that they're having up there. Okay? So, you look at 1862, what major events going on in the United States in 1862? Civil War. The Civil War started, and America is sort of in the middle of this major, national identity crisis and catastrophe, if you will. And the dispensational ideas of Darby are going to begin to be introduced into North America, both Canada and the United States, at roughly the time of the American Civil War. That's why last Sunday we looked at the time period from 1800 to 1860. Because it's roughly in 1860 that these ideas of dispensational theology are going to really start to make a difference in the thinking of the way Americans are viewing the Bible and eschatology. Darby ventured into the United States for 4 weeks during his first American trip and was not too impressed with the state of the American church. He said, "The church is more worldly in America. And anywhere you find it, that is the professing bodies, the world, professedly such, inordinately wicked, yet I doubt not many Christians, and some really devoted ones." So, Darby acknowledges that there are true believers in the American churches, but his overall assessment of the American churches upon his first visit is, on a whole, not very complimentary. Okay? Now, is that pretty much what you would expect from him, though? Because remember, he's a separatist. He broke away from the Church of England, and he thinks that the organized church is in ruin, and so on. And so it's not a surprise that he would have this sort of opinion when he looks at the American churches. Except for his journey from Chicago to San Francisco in the spring of 1875 when he was traveling to New Zealand, and a trip in June 1876, Darby appears to have confined his United States itineraries to the area from Detroit to Chicago to St. Louis in the Midwest, and the area from Boston to New York in the East. He generally traveled from Chicago and Detroit to New York and Boston by way of Canada. So there is one instance where he actually goes to New Zealand. And he goes to New Zealand by passing through America and picking up a boat somewhere in California and heading toward New Zealand. But beyond that occasion, he's limiting the majority of his itinerary movements are limited to a stretch spanning from St. Louis, Chicago to Detroit in the Midwest. And then he moved between Boston and New York on the East Coast. And he seems to be always entering the country by way of Canada, from the itineraries and from the the things that I was able to read about this. But that's generally how Darby was moving and functioning in this part of his ministry. So you think about that, and if he's entering through Canada, he's probably obviously entering into the Midwest through Detroit. So it's somewhat interesting to think of Darby as sort of passing through Michigan on his way to Chicago and St. Louis. But this appears to be the way that he sort of did things. Yeah.
One of the things about it, we got to realize that he was traveling by wagon most of the time. It wasn't even the process of him announcing where he was going to be. He could probably get there as quick as the mail would get there when it came to showing up at different points. He made.
By the end of this, certainly there are some rails the Civil War, no doubt. There's definitely rail traffic.
And that would explain traveling from the major cities to major cities. That
right.
Would be connected by rail.
Right. And, obviously, that makes, you want to have the biggest impact. Where do you want to go? You want to go where the people are, obviously. So Darby is, his movements seem to be following these patterns. So at first, Darby was attracted to the United States by the number of his converts who had immigrated to Europe. So it's interesting. It seems that his initial interest in coming to North America stems from brethren that had relocated out of Britain to either Canada or the United States. So it seems as if his initial interest in coming to the United States is to reinforce the faith of some of these brethren that had immigrated to the United States and Canada. All right. Darby wrote the following regarding his trip to America in 1862. My object was to visit the French and Swiss brethren. So why is he going? To visit the people that he already basically knows and is aware of. Okay. Save in one locality, I through mercy effected. And was out in the prairies, living among them as in old times, and glad indeed to see them as they are. But it has renewed bonds with the saints in general, cheered them, and I trust been directly helpful to them. The system of coming to America, taking up land without being able to pay for it, which they generally fell into, as is the custom, had brought them spiritually low, pinching as they must to pay, or careless in paying. But they have felt it, and there has been a reaction in conscience, which has had a most helpful effect on them, and there is a living desire of profiting by the word. Many neighboring French came, and their meeting house could not hold the people. So he's kind of telling that these guys are kind of having it economically pretty rough as they come across, but they seem to still be interested in obviously studying the word and so on. Darby never gave up ministering to the European immigrant population of the United States, but in 1873 he found a more influential platform, especially in the larger cities of the Midwest and East. Darby began to preach publicly, or more frequently to teach privately, both laymen and ministers from the American denominations. Now, at some point in the 1870s, Darby begins to have access to the pulpits of some of the largest denominational preachers in the United States. Not only does he have access to their pulpits, but he also has access to them privately and is engaging in pretty heavy doctrinal theological conversation with some of the largest denominational teachers in this country at the time. Now, if you look at the quote here that goes with this point, the work in the United States was essentially among settlers, my presence among real Americans, God opening the way distinctly. Some new gatherings are formed, weak, but still a testimony, and wholly of such, I have had large readings and some lectures in various places. Still there are doors open to truth, and I am able in various places and circumstances to bring the whole truth before ministers and people, and they interested in it. So what's his testimony here? as he's here, is his opportunity expanding to get this information out? And not only is it expanding, but is he testifying that the people are interested in what he has to say? Okay? So you're going to start to see here again the influence of dispensational theology going to start to have an impact on American millenarianism. Getting ahead of myself again there. They, brethren preachers, were willing to preach at any pulpit open to them, and many were. Because of their zeal and upright character, they were often very influential. The pulpits of A.J. Gordon at Clarendon Street Baptist Church in Boston, D.L. Moody in Chicago, and J.H. Brooks at Walnut Street Presbyterian Church in St. Louis were open to them, and there was widespread sympathy for many of their views. Now listen, Darby knew D.L. Moody. D.L. Moody was exposed to dispensational theology from Darby himself, and also from a guy named McIntosh, who we'll talk about in a future lesson. So these are some of the largest influential American denominational preachers of the day. Gordon, Brooks, Moody, certainly everybody, anybody knows anything about the history of Christianity in America has heard of Moody. I mean, Moody Bible Institute, all the things that are there in Chicago. If you've never been to Moody Church, if you're ever in Chicago, you should go down there and check it out. It's kind of a cool experience to go down there and look at that stuff, because there's a history there, and dispensational theology played a part in that history. Now, to a large degree, Moody is going to sort of downplay a lot of dispensational distinctives in his ministry, and Darby's not going to really like him because of it, because he views him as selling out. In a lot of ways. So despite the warm reception in certain parts of the country, Darby had difficulty convincing Americans to accept the whole of his theology. Darby was least successful in convincing Americans to accept his doctrine of the ruin of Christendom, obligated a minister or parishioner to abandon his former denomination to meet with the brethren, gathered only in the Lord's name. In the West, he's referring, i.e., to the Midwest, a good many Presbyterians, several ministers among them, teach the Lord's coming, the presence of the Holy Ghost, that all sects are wrong, but yet few move from their place. Now, one of his biggest frustrations is this. Americans, by and large, were eating up what he had to say about dispensational theology and about his views of eschatology, the end times, the rapture, all that stuff. But where they would not go along with Darby is in this separatist idea that would have forced them to leave their denominations. So the American denominationalism is one of the areas where American Christians did not embrace what Darby had to say. They embraced him on certain levels and on certain points of doctrine, but they would not go along with him regarding this whole idea that they needed to leave the denominational church and meet exclusively with the brethren. So, if we could just stop just for a second, what can we gather from this so far? Is dispensational theology affecting the American mindset about eschatology and theology in general? Yeah, it certainly is. Okay, not only in a general sense, but it's capturing some of the leaders of some of these big denominational churches. Now, men like Gordon and Brooks, they are never going to leave the Baptist Church, and they are never going to leave the Presbyterian Church, but they are going to teach on a whole, a lot of what Darby has to say about the body of Christ, about the end times, about the rapture, and about the second coming. So there's definitely a substantial influence here. Lee?
Yeah, just a comment. It might be important, might not. But I'm not at all convinced, or I am convinced, that the L.O. bought into the grace messages, we would know it pretty thoroughly. His first teacher that he appointed to the Institute was, we would call him an Acts 28 dispensationalist, George Williams.
And then Sankey and Moody often preached at our grace church there out on Montauk Point on many occasions. In fact, Ira Sankey, who was the companion of Moody, the songwriter, his family is still a member of that our grace church there, which is a part of our history.
Is that Hilltop Bible Church?
No.
What's
it's out, where Craig Apel used to be the pastor. I don't know who's the pastor there now, but anyway, it's right there out on Long Island, New York.
Okay.
Yes. So there's definitely, and then another interesting point is that Moody refused to be baptized and never called himself Reverend. He insisted on being called Mr. Moody. So there are a lot of indications that he bought into, and certainly into the Reverend theology and philosophy. I don't know how completely, but I just think that's important or interesting in passing.
Well, yeah, and he certainly was influenced by him. Just through the geographical contact that he no doubt had with him. So slow and difficult though it was, the work of the Plymouth Brethren in the United States began to attract notice in the 1870s. As a result of proselytizing in Chicago, Robert T. Grant, a Brethren evangelist, was able to report to Darby in 1868 that he had won some promising young men. Moody, he noted, is quite in a pet about so many of them leaving him who were his best workers. So I think what he means is that maybe he's speaking to a little bit of what Lee had to say, that Moody on some level does understand some of these things. And I'm not totally sure what to make of that statement, again, other than to say that there are documented cases of the fact that Brethren from very early on in Moody's ministry were involved and influential on Moody's thinking as he sort of got going. Thomas Korski encapsulated many of the misgivings American Christians had about the Plymouth Brethren in an 1872 article titled "The Plymouth Brethren" in the Princeton Review. Korski stated, "The aim of the Brethren is to gather churches out of churches." to disintegrate all existing bodies by opening a door in each, not for the exit of the faithless and false-hearted, but of the pious and the good, and accordingly they prowl unceasingly around all churches, seeking to reap where they have not sown, and leaving to the denominations generally the exclusive privilege of evangelizing the masses. Woo! Somebody's not happy. So what's he basically accusing them of? But yeah, they go into a church, they teach their stuff with the goal of doing what? Drawing people out of those denominational churches and bringing them into Brethren meetings. Now that's in the Princeton Theological Review, okay? So this is a theological periodical of Princeton Theological Seminary that's saying this in the year 1872. So now, read between the lines there, and what does that tell you about what's going on? If Darby comes over first in 1862, and by 1872 the Princeton Theological Review is saying that about the methods and tactics of the Brethren, well, clearly had Brethrenism been spreading around the country to a point where it's got the attention of the editors at the Princeton Theological Review. Okay? So that's just another point about the influence that dispensational theology through the Brethren, which the Brethren were teaching, was having, and how, to what degree, Americans were being made aware of these things. Darby made his great impact in the United States, however, outside of the Brethren congregations in a few large cities: St. Louis, Chicago, New York, and Boston. Since it is just these centers that dispensational theology had the most effect upon the American denominations and won its most foremost champions among denominational leaders, as distinct from the Congress of the Plymouth Brethren, a detailed picture of Darby's activities in these cities ought to prove most helpful. Unfortunately, his correspondence does not reveal much about the details of his life. So what I've done here is I've kind of broken this down into looking at the four major cities that Darby ministers in. And the first one we want to look at is St. Louis. Okay? St. Louis. Darby stated the following regarding his experience in St. Louis during the summer of 1872. I have had good opportunities here, and the door open as it has not been, and I am in pretty full intercourse with those exercised, among whom are more than one official minister. So what does he mean? He means he's got open doors of conversation with some of the higher-ups and ranking ministers in the denominational churches of the city of St. Louis. Now, whether Darby is referring to James Hall Brooks, pastor of the Walnut Street Presbyterian Church, remains an intriguing but unanswerable question. Brooks became a leader in American Millenarian conferences soon after this visit, and for most of the remainder of his life taught a dispensational theology. Now, according to Ironside now, Darby and other brethren preachers had preached in Dr. James Hall Brooks's St. Louis church, and then I have two quotes here. Dr. Brooks knew and loved many of them. His pulpit had often been open to them. J.N. Darby, Malachi Taylor, and Paul, how do you say this guy's name?
Loisel.
And others had preached in his church at various times. So Ironside says that Darby preached at Brooks's church. Dr. James H. Brooks, second quote now, in whose church Mr. Darby held 2 weeks' meetings while in St. Louis in the 70s, considered him one of the greatest Bible scholars of his generation. Okay? Now, you say, well, why is that important? Well,
if Darby, if we can trust that testimony, and I think you can substantiate it in many different ways, then Darby comes to the church, I'm going to say in 1872 in St. Louis, of Brooks. So Darby is going to teach Brooks. Is it ES or S?
ES.
So Darby teaches Brooks. Brooks then is going to become a leader in the prophetic Bible conference movement. We'll see in a few weeks, this becomes known as the Niagara Bible Conference Movement. They meet at Niagara Falls over the last 20 years of the 1800s, and many, many dispensational subjects and things are discussed at that meeting. So Darby comes in 1872 and meets Brooks, and I believe teaches in Brooks's church. Brooks learns dispensational theology and becomes a leader in the prophetic Bible Conference Movement, and guess who learns dispensational theology from Brooks? A little guy you might have heard of named C.I. Schofield. Schofield learns dispensational theology from Brooks.
If you look at the dates, when we talk about Schofield specifically later on, I'm going to talk to you about when Schofield is in St. Louis,
and there's potential overlap between when Schofield is in St. Louis and when Darby's there. So there's a very high degree of probability that not only does Darby teach Brooks directly, but there's also a high degree of probability that Darby knew Schofield. Okay? So this work in St. Louis here is converting, I don't know if that's the right word, but Brooks is going to become a dispensationalist. Okay? He's going to understand the difference between the rapture and the second coming. He's admittedly going to be an Acts 2 dispensationalist, okay? But he's going to be a dispensationalist, and he's going to become a leader in this prophetic Bible conference movement, of which Schofield is going to be a part, as well as some of the other men we're going to talk about here.
So, in my opinion, it's a virtual historical certainty that Brooks knew Darby, that Darby taught in Brooks's church, and taught dispensational theology to Brooks, that Brooks embraced. Now, maybe I should have done it here, but I chose to do it in a later lesson.
to show you what Brooks' dispensational scheme is. He believed in seven dispensations, and it almost matches identical with who? Schofield. Okay? Now, before we move on from St. Louis, does anybody have any questions or comments about that? Yeah?
Just backing up to the little thing that you read that was written in that
Princeton?
Yeah. That quote itself, anyway, doesn't seem to be having any problem with what Darby is teaching. Simply that he's skimming off the brightest and the best and taking them away from the established churches and leaving them stuck with the people that don't know anything.
Yeah, I think certainly that the quote does only speak to that directly. But I think that some of the boys at the Princeton Theological Review were none too happy either with what Darby was actually teaching. So, I mean, they're mad at him for both things.
That's not
unlike what
we're accused of.
Yes, we're accused of doing the same things.
Loss of power.
We're accused of, our grace people are accused all the time of getting into, say, a Baptist church or an IFCA church and stirring up issues about baptism and, you know, right division and Paul and the mystery and so forth and trying to remove people from those groups into their own group.
And thankfully, we've seen any number of those churches completely turned around.
And sometimes, I know there's a church in Concord, South Carolina, that the pastor was a Baptist pastor. He heard Richard on the radio, and he slowly began teaching mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalism to his congregation, and eventually he changed the name of the church, the Grace Bible Church, and now it's a Grace Church, and any of the Baptists that didn't like it, they left, and now it's a Grace Church. Lolly had her hand up first, but I'll get to you in a second. But see, that's one of my points here, Lyle, is that Brooks may arguably be the preeminent Presbyterian pastor in the entire country at this time in history, and he's buddy buddy with Darby and letting Darby teach in his own pulpit.
So if
right, there's nobody above him saying you can't let this guy teach. Okay, so he's basically making that call on his own and doing it because he agrees with what he has to say about certain things. Ronnie?
Well, what's really nice about the technology that we have today, even just where I work, there's a couple of people that I've been talking to a little bit about dispensational theology, and they're very, very receptive to it. And the temptation is to tell them, well, come on over and sit after Brian. But actually they can just go on the internet and learn these things and fully impact their whole church.
If the church will let them do it.
So far they're letting them.
Well, I mean, that's true. That's good. We'll see how long that lasts. Lee?
Now, please allow me one more comment. Years ago, I was at Union Cumberland Presbyterian Church in Kentucky. And when I preached the first sermon, the pastor met me at the door and said, you're a dispensationalist, aren't you? And I said, yes. And he said, I want you to know I'm not in trouble with this church. And anyway, to make a long story short, before 2 weeks of meetings were over, he embraced the grace message. Today, that church, and I preach there often, is now called Union Grace Church. And they made the transition. As far as I know, I don't think they lost a soul. It's still a very good church.
That's good.
It happens because I mentioned it's a Presbyterian church.
It does happen.
And Donald Gray Barnhouse, was a great Bible teacher. He was Presbyterian. But he was very thorough, Acts 2 dispensation, but he was a thorough going dispensation. So they are at least accepted, especially if they get any kind of preeminence in the fellowship,
the
denomination.
Yeah.
That's a rare thing, but it happens.
Next, I appreciate you sharing that. I want to shift to Chicago now. Will be the next geographical center, okay?
There is more clarity regarding Darby's ministry in Chicago than in St. Louis. The Chicagoan who most characterized the American style of religion at the time was Dwight L. Moody. Since Moody had a hand in everything religious in Chicago, it is not surprising to discover that he and Darby met and exchanged views. Darby found Moody shockingly ignorant of what Darby considered the first principles of the gospel. So here's Darby meeting Moody and thinking that one of the most iconic, you know, American evangelists in the history of the country, and Darby thinks he's ignorant regarding the gospel. And then here's a quote here. It says, as to work at Edinburgh, I dare say there have been conversations, and one must bless God for that. But Moody, before he came to England, denied openly all work of grace and conversion and denounced it as diabolical in his own pulpit. I hear he has got on in this subject that M's tract did him good, which is a great measure of resume of the brother's teaching. So Darby's saying that who corrected Moody? The brethren did. Okay? The author not concealing in his intercourse with others where he learned it. But some of Moody's false doctrine was taught in his public ministrations in Edinburgh, according to R. and M.'s accounts, which no doubt is correct, for we discussed it at Chicago. And he held it there, namely that no man is condemned for his sins, but for not coming to the refuge. Sins are all born and put away for everybody. So clearly Moody comes to Edinburgh, and Darby has already met Moody previous to his coming to Edinburgh, according to Darby's own testimony. Now, by 1875, Darby had changed his opinion of Moody, though, somewhat. But only because he felt that Moody had greatly got on in the truth. Darby's reputation in Chicago seems to have markedly improved. He noted in 1875, I am suddenly in great vogue with a certain number. So there's all these very interesting, fascinating things that I wish we had more time to look into. But we just don't. But the reality is that do these two men know each other? Do they have conversation back and forth between them? And are they no doubt sharing and talking about these doctrinal issues?
Moody at the time of his conversion was a Unitarian.
Yeah.
So I can understand that he had very little grasp of the truth at that point, even as he began his ministry. So Darby apparently is right. He had a very poor understanding. But he was a Unitarian, believe it or not.
And it's just amazing to think that Moody was corrected by the brethren.
Yep, that's great.
Who, you know, by and large, these specific brethren are no doubt, you know, dispensational, and they're having an impact on Moody, you know, from a very early time in his ministry.
Brian,
yeah.
Had all the splits in the brethren happened yet at that
point? A lot of them had already happened.
Yeah.
Back in the old country, yeah.
Okay.
New York. Although Darby visited New York at least 9 times and stayed in the city for 5 months, from October 1867 to January 1868, and for 4 months, from November 1874 through February 1875, his letters reveal little about his activities. As usual, Darby's first impressions were bleak. He found New York ecclesiastically in total confusion. But the truth has spread, after all, considerably, and some fruits even now appear. Not only in many souls who have found peace and see clear as to grace, of which there are many, I find some new ones constantly. So that the truth is borne witness to and propagated by them, people seeing it in them the effect. But the Lord's coming is planted in many souls. So obviously, what's he talking about there? I think he's talking about the rapture, and that they have seen, though not all, its connection with the church, and some have at once seen the state of things around them. There are others, less simple perhaps, but in heart seeing what is right. Strong as is the influence of belonging to a church here,
for position, and everything depended on it, with most, at least in their estimation, the evil state of things is beginning to be felt. What it is, that is, for its effect was felt by upright souls often before, and through mercy I hear daily of souls that the word has reached for conversion, or finding peace, or getting clear as to position of themselves or the church. Though public meetings I may say I have none, but I meet with people. People interested come in small numbers. I have reading meetings and so on. So, there's what he has to say about his time in New York. Again, it's a mixed bag, I guess, is what you would how you would characterize it for him. Boston. Boston offers one of the clearest pictures of Darby's ministry in America. He traveled to Boston on at least 8 occasions, settling down twice for periods of at least 2 months. During the first months of October of 1875 and the last few of 1876, during 1865 and for some years later, Darby reached a great many Millerite millenarians in the Boston area. As Darby described the situation, he was able to destroy their pretensions at prophetic interpretation and convince a good many of them that they were mistaken. Their grand array proved to be ignorance and no more, and the foundations fell. This did every way much good. Their whole relative position was altered. Their scraps of Greek and Hebrew I could meet, and their calculations of dates for the Lord's coming only baffled them. The Word of God resumed its ascendancy, but still it was only some deliverances and an unfinished work. But a door was opened in Boston, and I was greatly begged to stay. One devoted man, I trust, delivered from danger, having just now, as I was leaving, got a fine room where he wants me to speak. Now, the question is now, who is this guy? All right, let's look at the next point. In Boston, I got ahead of myself again here, I apologize. In Boston, Darby also won a notable convert to the Fleming Brethren from Millerite Adventism. Mr. F.G. Brown, an elder in the Adventist Church, and with Joshua V. Himes, a member of the English Mission in 1846, was converted to the Brethren about the same time and opened a book and tract depot at Pemberton Square, Boston. Okay? In 1875, Darby stated the following regarding his time in Boston. A notion of perfectionism. Now, this would be the Methodist holiness perfectionist movement that was popular in the latter half of the 1800s in this country. A notion of perfectionism accompanied by a wild looking for the Spirit is one thing that has one has to contend with. Merely deliverance, really, with a taint of Wesleyan perfectionism. But a good deal of perfectionism, pretension, and some good. There can be no doubt that a testimony is far raised up if we look at what is visible. It is a cloud, a man's hand. If there is faithful devotees, others will reap. That is my great desire now. We have more to do now with injuries than with heretics. Than with heretics. Yesterday, I had the two principal Wesleyan ministers and their chief members and some others all the afternoon on deliverance from sin, full acceptance, the Lord's coming. So here's Darby meeting with these guys, and he's just running down the litany of stuff with them that we've already gone over that he teaches. Then notice what it says. It was, on the whole, a satisfactory meeting. One of the ministers was deeply interested in the truth and said he should return. Also, the chief Baptist minister. Now, in this last comment about the chief Baptist minister of Boston, Darby has managed, as usual, to be tantalizingly imprecise. one of the chief Baptist ministers in Boston at the time was in, I'm just going to say Gordon, A.J. Gordon is mostly how you will see it written. Pastor of the Clarendon Street Baptist Church from 1985. He wasn't there from 1869 to 1985. I'm going to have to check that date. I think it's 1885, I believe. He joined James Fall Brooks to lead the millenarian movement during the last quarter of the 19th century. But this little hint is the closest the historian can come to showing that Darby had any direct contact with A.J. Gordon. A.J. Gordon is going to team up with Brooks. And these two guys right here are going to be the two biggest leaders of this prophetic Bible conference movement. And it's fascinating that this guy is from Boston. Brooks is from St. Louis. Two of the major cities where Darby spent the most amount of time. Okay? Now, we're going to look next week at some other information that pretty much puts a nail in the coffin that Gordon knew Brooks. That Gordon knew Darby. Okay? So, Darby crossed the Atlantic for the last time in 1877. At which time he said, at my age, and by the way, he's 77 years old now, I shall hardly return to America. In his last letter penned in North America, Darby reflected upon his 16 years of labor in the Western Hemisphere. I now propose to depart for Europe on Saturday, God willing, embarking at Quebec. So again, that proves that he usually entered through where? Canada. And if God in His unfailing goodness grant me a quiet passage, I hope to obtain some rest. The position of the brethren is in some slight respects altered. There is an acknowledgement here in the United States of their acquaintance with the Word such as nowhere else. They are not the less opposed to us. They are not the less opposed to us, but they buy the books and come in numbers to the Bible readings. They feel they must reckon with us, as they say. The Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Baptists are minded to oppose. The first are unanimous, the ministers, as everywhere, opposing our work, and some write about it. The remainder study much what this, to them, a new movement means. The godly ones are discontented with the sermons, and some, like Moody, endeavor to help by a strenuous effort of activity. So there he implies that who's helping him? Moody. But I let all the movements pass. The truth is spreading. The truth of the Holy Spirit's presence. Conquest upon the Lord being glorified, for He as the Son of Man glorified God on the cross and the coming of the Lord. These are the fundamental truths of the gospel based upon the finished work of Christ. Our controversy is essentially with unbelievers that I deeply feel, and with the thought that the incarnation was a union of the Lord with humanity, the human race, because on the contrary it is lost, and our union is with the glorified man at God's right hand, and thus of believers only through the Holy Ghost. The two springs are in Germany, but they are spreading in Europe and in America. But we are at the end of days. For some time the coming of the Lord hath wrought in souls far and wide. The doctrine is spreading wonderfully. All right, so before we look at those last two quotes on the other page, what can we sort of take from all this? Just trying to summarize. Starting in the 1860s, 1860s, that's what I meant. Starting in the 1860s, Darby and the brethren come to the United States. Darby and the brethren have meetings of all different sorts, sizes, and so on.
He has access to, they have access to some of the biggest pulpits in the biggest metropolitan areas of the country. And after 16 years, in Darby's last letter, before he goes home for the last time, at the age of 77, he looks at what he's done in the United States and he says, the truth is what?
Spreading.
So did Darby have a perception and an understanding that dispensational truth, the truth of the Lord's coming, the truth of the total forgiveness of sins and so on, were having an impact in the United States and Canada? There's no doubt about that in my mind. Okay? So, at about this time, there were 88 brethren meetings in existence. None of them large. The New York City meetings, for example, counted about 50 members. Philadelphia, a few more than 20. And Springfield, Illinois, hardly 10. Throughout his ministry in the United States, Darby had been frustrated by his inability to arouse more dissatisfaction among Americans with their denominations. Darby never understood the difference that the disestablishment of the church had made in the United States, or how much his own doctrine of the ruin of the church had been shaped by early 19th century British social conditions. The Americans show little concern about abandoning their denominations remained the greatest puzzle of Darby's American experience. The thing that Darby can't understand is why these cursed Americans won't leave their denomination. Okay? They'll listen to everything else I gotta say, but they won't what? They won't leave the denomination. But, and these are my points now here, okay? Why is there a quote there? I'm not sure. But Darby did do much to publicize his own brand of dispensational theology. Although Darby thought them inconsistent, many American ministers and laymen accepted his theology. This is important. Accepted his theology without feeling obligated to join his sect. To determine precisely who these men were and how many of them were convinced by Darby has proved almost impossible. So, do they believe and understand in large numbers Darby's dispensational teaching? Yes. But what frustrates Darby is why they could get that, but then not leave their what? Denominations and become a part of what? Of the brethren sect. So, last point. Next Sunday, then, what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the impact of Darby's dispensationalism on the mainstream millenarian movement in the United States. Okay? Yeah.
I think it's even worse today as far as we have a lot of grace churches that aren't really teaching grace messages. And so pastors then and now are still giving into that social pressure of not being so different that people will refuse to go. They're going for numbers.
Then, as they are now, they're going for numbers to their congregations and that. Because that's bringing
the money
and,
you know, all that stuff. But, you know, it hasn't changed a whole lot. Not even in our
race. No, it hasn't changed. And I think you're right. I mean, why would a guy like Brooks and Kirk, why would they embrace dispensationalism but not leave the denominations? To me, it's got to be a financial reason. I mean, well, it's got to be one of the reasons. I mean, how much money, how much position do they stand to lose if they go along with Darby on those points? But yet they're more than willing to go along with them on the dispensational points, and not only that, but become major players in a major prophetic Bible conference movement that is going to do a lot to spread the issues of the rapture and dispensational theology to an even bigger audience. So certainly there's a lot of things here that you've got to scratch your head about a little bit and wonder, you know, what's going on. Lee and then Ronnie.
Yeah, I want to tell everybody I agree 100% with that. I was a Baptist preacher for 19 years. And that was my struggle. It wasn't the truth I knew. I saw what you said, what you see that Paul is unique. He had a distinctive message. There was no backing out, but the question is, what's it going to cost me?
Yeah.
I could easily read the handwriting on the wall. And my own father said, man, you've ruined your ministry. You'll just ruin your ministry. And we had a couple hundred people there, 300 people. And he was right. When I announced that I had changed my theology, then they started leaving like flies. And then, and that's when they asked for my resignation. But it was the what's going to cost me. But my conviction was, if God couldn't trust me with this truth, and I'm a student, how can He trust me for further revelation, further understanding of truth? And that was what convinced me. Was what do you do with the truth?
Yeah. Ronnie?
In the Sandine quote on page 7, where Darby never understood the difference that the disestablishment of the church had made in the United States, what does he mean by the disestablishment of the church? Is he talking about separation of church and state?
I don't want to put words in Sandine's mouth here, okay? But I think what he means is the fact that, you remember when we talked about the lesson I did on the old religion and the new world, and I talked about how there's something very American, if you will, about these denominations. Because what they did is they allowed all of these different sets of immigrants to come to the Americas and coexist with other Christian groups that they did not share total agreement with, under the understanding that we're all what? We're all Christian. And so there's an inherent denominational mindset within America that I think Darby never understood because he wasn't an American. I think that's kind of what Sandine is talking about. And if that is what he's talking about, I think he is right. Because even to our day, if you look at the church in America, it is still highly denominationalized. So I think that might have something to do with what he's talking about. And plus, by the time Darby comes over here, Europe, the situation in Europe is totally different too, because Europe's gone through all these religious wars. They fought the wars of the Catholics and the Protestants. They've done all this stuff over in Europe, and there's a whole different mentality that these European people have to a lot of this stuff than Americans had, especially second, third, fourth generation Americans that have never known anything else but this American denominational system of tradition that was established in the United States. So I think, now, you should not misunderstand me. I'm not saying it's a good thing, because I don't think that it is a good thing, that type of denominationalism. I'm just trying to say that's the way it is, and the impact of it, I don't think Darby ever fully grasped that denominationalism is somehow a part of the fabric of what it means to be a Christian in America. And I think to a large degree that's still true, because people always identify themselves, even in our day, by what denomination they're a part of. So I don't think it's something that we've ever gotten away from, but it was certainly something that frustrated Darby. And it's also possibly a bias of Sandine. Okay?
What denomination does he deal from?
Do you know, Mike? I don't know. Yeah. I'm not totally sure. But so next week we'll go to the next step. Thanks for your attention, and we got to quit. It's 5 minutes past. So talk to you later.